Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, January 8th, 2014. Quite a few topics to talk about tonight, but the first thing, my goodness, a mainstream announcement regarding Planet X. Now, this is really interesting. A website called weather.com, which is a Rothschild subsidiary, they own that and use that to spread disinformation about weather. But on, I guess this came out December 1st, a number of astronomers have announced that they have determined that there are at least two, not one, but two Planet X objects beyond the orbit of Pluto, and they talk about this matter-of-factly as if it's just the greatest discovery since sliced bread. They said that there's a lot of support for this in the astronomy community, and I'm thinking to myself, what in the world is going on here? So you got the Rothschild disinformation weather site making an announcement about astronomy that there are Planet X objects at the edge of the solar system, beyond the solar system, and then they say that, and this I've talked about before in this show, that these automated sky searches have searched about 2%, that's 2% of the sky, and of course, they only go out so far. So that's only 2% of the sky that they're able to reach with this telescopic professional automated search equipment. The searches in the future might go out 10 or 100 times as far. So you can see that they're finding these many, many objects, in fact, in a region that is just extremely small compared to the entire sky, and it's very limited in the distance that they can search to. But they've already discovered what they consider are two major Planet X objects, not one, but two. And here's what they're saying. They're seeing a bunch of little, like 200 mile diameter planets. This is like, you know, the kind of Pluto-sized planets. And then they're all moving in a certain pattern, which would implicate that there's a bigger object kind of shepherding or corralling them out there. And so they're very confident of this. They don't talk about orbits. Obviously, these orbits could be anything. They could be orbits that come into the solar system. But I just get such this is laughable because over decades, they have been denying this in the entire astronomical community, hammer, tooth, and nail. And without any reprise, my name has been just strewn in the mud with the likes of crazy ladies talking to aliens and every other Planet X nutcase that happened to crawl out from under a rock. I have spent much of my radio time, which I pay for myself, debunking Planet X garbage for you, the people out there, to give it somewhat a patch of sanity. Then you've had the NASA people on the other side claiming that there was no such thing, and now you've got this announcement, and I made a comical posting on my webpage. I said, gee, you better wake Phil Plait up out of his moronic stupor and tell him that he's out of a job, because the biggest thing he did was debunk Planet X people. Now mainstream astronomers are claiming that just like falling off a rock, easy as pie, there are Planet X objects out there, and they're going to find lots of them. Anyway, I'm not going to waste a lot of time on this show dealing with that, just making an announcement, because a listener wrote in and basically wrote a very long, detailed email asking all kinds of Planet X questions. They've been on the internet. They understand from the internet that Planet X is already here. It's going to come crashing by. And I said, you are the victim of a lot of misinformation. on the internet. And like I made an announcement last week, some people have been name-dropping my name on radio shows dealing with Planet X, and let me just make it clear that I'm not aware of any objects that are massive objects coming into the solar system that are going to destroy Earth or anything like that. So, but the people are asking me, you know, when the pole shift will be and, all of this. They talk about magnetic instead of gravitational. What I'd suggest is people study, first of all, just get my books and read them, and you'll understand the issue with Planet X. First of all, there are many Planet X objects, and that's why, in a sense, I get a kick out of this astronomical official announcement, because they're talking not about one, but about two, and if there's two, there's 10, and if there's 10, there's 100, if you see what I mean. So it looks like they are gearing up, let's put it that way, for some announcements in the realm of Planet X. Okay, so anyway, I'm not going to talk any more about that. I want to talk a little bit about the WING project, which really I haven't talked about in a while. But there is progress going on in the background. This is based on my most recent book, McCanny Wing Generator World Energy Project. And for people who are working on this, so there's a number of people out there that are actively working on their own home or initial industry type projects dealing with my technology. This will remain active, and I'm sorry I have so many things on my plate, but I wanted this out there and people working on it. Now it's time to review again and see how everybody's doing. So I'll be making the rounds here pretty shortly, seeing how everybody's doing with their projects. But I think it's important to understand that in the next 10 years, the entire coal, oil, nuclear energy industries could be reversed and completely eliminated with the WING technology. So just a little bit of an update on that. Here's a listener question. Where does the O2 come from in what I'm talking about, the oxygen and the water coming into the atmosphere, into Earth's atmosphere, and in fact into comet atmospheres, into the when the oxygen and the hydrogen combine and form water, when all of the other chemicals, the carbons and nitrogens, the sulfurs, the oxygens, when these are all combining in outer space in the comet tail to form the entourage, the multitude of chemicals that are forming in the comet tail. And you have to understand that this is a mechanism for the formation of planets. Although many, many, many comets are small, and basically they don't have enough gravitational field to hold all of this. So as the ions come in and become combined into larger chemical strings, they become neutralized because there's an electron cloud around the nucleus, and then they come floating out as neutrals, and you actually can measure these, and that's what fools astronomers, space scientists, into thinking they're seeing material coming off the comet nucleus. But the listener question was going a step further. Where on Earth, or in the heavens, whatever, do these chemicals come from? And so anyway, I want to explain a little bit about how the solar system works. And I'm not going to go all the way back to how does oxygen form in the universe, but what happens is the solar system is something like a centrifuge. Now, in let's say you go to the hospital and they take a blood sample, and there you have a little test tube full of your blood. Well, they put that blood in what's known as a centrifuge. It's a little spinning disc with that test tube radially outward, with the top of the test tube with the cork in it at the center part, and the bottom of the test tube, the round part, down towards the outer part, and they spin it very fast. Now, the centrifugal process, what does it do? The denser objects move to the far end of the tube. because they are denser. The less dense objects, in a sense, float up to the top, and so what you get is a nice layering of all the various components of your blood, and then they take various components and they study them. But anyway, that's a centrifuge. Now, the solar system acts in a similar manner, but it's the solar wind that is doing this. It's a wind of primarily protons and all types of atoms, but primarily it's hydrogen. It's the main component in the solar wind is hydrogen. There's a lesser current of electrons, and this is one of my main discoveries, that there is a differential charge in the solar wind. And people with spacecraft, NASA, etc., have claimed they've measured, and they say the solar wind is neutral, and they've measured it. Well, the morons don't understand that you cannot make a measurement in outer space with a single spacecraft, because what happens is if there's an excess of protons, then the spacecraft charges up to a positive potential, and it retards protons to the point in which electrons and protons are coming equally into the sensors. The spacecraft charges up, and there's no way to measure this in outer space because there's no ground. Like when you measure voltages in the real world, you have two points. You have a probe here and a probe at point A and a probe at point B, and that's literally the definition of a potential difference of a voltage. It's literally the difference in potential between two points. So how on earth do you measure this with a single spacecraft? Well, you simply don't. It's a basic physics 101 question. Okay, so now going back to the solar wind is literally a wind, and it affects particles, especially small atomic particles and small molecules. It affects everything up to about the micron-sized dust particles. Above that, they are less affected by the solar wind, and when you get up to something the size of a golf ball, it's not affected at all, simply by the solar wind. There are other effects, charging effects. As these objects discharge the solar capacitor, then there are other effects that occur. But I'm just talking about the small objects, like the atomic objects, like oxygen, diatomic hydrogen, sulfur, sulfide dioxide, build up the small basic molecules, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, the NH carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen, hydrogen, which build up the organic molecules and the basis of organic molecules. Okay, so as these molecules get bigger, they become denser and less affected by the solar wind. So here's what's happening. The centrifugal effect, I would call it, but even though this is not a spinning test tube scenario, you have the solar wind, which differentiates in the heavier, like iron, etc. You find rings of iron, literally ringing the sun, ringing around the sun, moving around the sun. And this is what makes up the zodiacal light that you can see once or twice per year. It's a Saturn-like ring that surrounds the sun. And it's primarily, it's primarily made up of heavy metals. Well, what are the heavy metals doing near the sun? Why aren't there atomic species like oxygen or hydrogen? So what happens is as you move out into the solar system, it just so happens that Earth happens to be at a place in this centrifugal process of the solar wind differentiating the molecular and atomic species. We're at about the place where water is most abundant, and that's true all the way out to Jupiter. When you get out to Jupiter, you get atoms like sulfur, which predominate. That's why Jupiter is red. That's why Io has an abundance of sulfur and sulfur dioxide. That's why when comets attach out into that far region by Jupiter, they pull in that sulfur from that region. They can pull it all the way into close to where Mars is or even close to where Earth is. And that's what I said. The ancients talk about the big comets having sulfur dioxide. It's an orangish color that is seen, the Red Hand of Death, for example. I've talked about this before. I talk about this on my 2-CD set, The Physics of Ancient Celestial Disasters. That reddish-orangish color is sulfur dioxide. Okay, so anyway, this is a differential process. So this entourage of atomic species exists in the solar system, and then the solar wind blows out, and it holds a lot of this stuff at bay. Out, and when I first started talking about this back in the late 70s, the understanding of the solar system was that the boundary of the solar wind was somewhere probably around the orbit of Jupiter. As the Voyager spacecraft went out, and this is one of the benefits that I had of being at Cornell during those critical years, 79 to 81, that's when the data was coming in that expanded our vision of where the solar system began and ended and the solar wind, the effects of the solar wind. That's why it was so important. And it's like I've said before, being in the right place at the right time, seeing that data come in, crystallized my ideas. And so basically now the understanding is very clear that the solar wind effect goes way beyond past Pluto, probably twice the distance of Pluto, where the boundary layer is. And they're saying that one of the pioneers, just crossed that boundary. They're saying, but it's very nebulous. But now let's look at another star. Let's look at other stars in general. You can see this cloud, I call it the nebular ion cloud. That was my original term that I used back in the late 70s when I was describing the solar capacitor that has the sun negatively charged relative to the outer nebular ring, and that provides the electric field in the solar system, all of the planets, comets coming in from afar discharge this. And then you find that's a very rich area where planets, larger gas planets, can form. And you actually see this in the pictures of other stars. So, the listener question, where does the oxygen come from that I was talking about coming into our atmosphere? And the fact that Mars is building up its atmosphere on a constant basis. When comet sighting spring went by, it built up a tremendous amount of atmosphere. Mars built up a considerable amount of atmosphere very quickly during the passage of sighting spring. That's because it connected electrically with that comet, and Mars being much bigger, creating a much bigger electrical discharge of the solar capacitor, pulled in a lot of material very quickly. And just another side note, I've talked many times about Mars losing its atmosphere. Losing its atmosphere when Venus the comet came by. This is thousands of years ago, and the ancients described this. That's one of the main things Velikovsky talks about, is in that the ancients talked about one of the very dramatic descriptions where Mars lost its atmosphere and oceans to a passing comet. So at any rate, great listener questions. I love these because it gives me a platform to talk about these very intricate topics. Just a comical note, I've talked before about SpaceX, about the Richard Branson effort, the Space One and the Space Two platforms to take people into outer space. And the fact that they were both within a week of each other blown up on the launch pad by somebody who just doesn't want you going into space, the general public. They think that's their private playground. And the companies like Martin Marietta and McDonald and the other major aerospace corporations, the Black Ops, that build the real space program, the one that you never see. But the point is that when you read the articles after those explosions on the launch pad, the message was very clear that, gee, this going into space stuff is real dangerous and you just don't want to do it. So today, CNN had an article out there, and the title of it was, don't forget, space is dangerous. Now, they don't want you to forget this. The message is, don't forget, space is dangerous. So at any rate, enough of that. Malarkey is a good Irish term. I just want to mention a guy named, I think his first name is Louis Picard. I hope I got the first name right there. I don't like misquoting people's names. He's the guy that flew around the world in a hot air balloon, and now he's building a solar plane, a solar panel powered airplane, completely electrical, to fly around the world nonstop. And it's called Solar Impulse 2. So you want to go on the internet and look at this. Solar Impulse 2 is the name. And now understand, we have electric cars. We certainly have electric bicycles and scooters. And now we have electrical solar-powered airplanes. Now, I just want to mention that every year there's a competition with cars. Engineering schools get together and build solar-powered cars, and they have a race and a competition. So, and then, of course, we have electric cars that are in use. We have the Tesla vehicles. We have Elon Musk, who is building a new factory in Nevada to make a commoner's electric car. He's building a battery factory and also another state-of-the-art, high-output solar panel factory. I think that's up in Pennsylvania, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere up in the Northeast. But at any rate, the whole issue of electrical is, it should have been here 100 years ago. Electric airplanes, etc., all exist already for mass markets. So what is the one thing that's missing here? What they need is a clean source of electricity. And, of course, that has to do with my wing project, which is going back on in the background. On what I do, just about everything I do, I would say, ends up in some kind of controversial note. But it's really gratifying to hear feedback from people. I got an email from a listener who bought the calendar, the emergency Sunstar clock calendar that I sell on my webpage, a unique item that you won't find anyplace else, that I invented, designed, and marketed, and it's been highly successful. So I get an email. This woman is a teacher at a homeschool, and the kids love this device, and they take it home, they check it out like a book in the library. And so I got an email, and she said, we've lost the paperwork, because it comes with some paperwork. The star wheel actually comes along with it, and then I think it's about 3 pages of instructions. Well, one of the students took it home and lost the paperwork, so I got the email, can I replace the paperwork? And, of course, we're sending that out to them so they have their paperwork. But it's very gratifying to know that the students love this device. And they're learning from it. There's a tremendous amount to learn from that little device. Not only just how to recalendar and create a Sunstar clock and then convert it with the little conversion table from sun time to watch time. Not only that, but it's just gratifying to me that my work is being recognized, and these kids love it. I got an email from a guy who's homeschooling kids. And they said one young girl, I don't know what the age, it sounded like upper grade school level, was really not interested in math. She was just struggling with math, having a hard time, and they gave her my Calculate Primes book. And now she's very interested in math. She's building her prime number tables, understanding where the number systems come from. And so that was another one. Another story came from a woman who also has a homeschool situation, in which she said she smiles when she hears her 8-year-old, I think it was 8-year-old if I'm not mistaken, maybe it was 8th grade or maybe it was 8-year-old, saying that comets are not dirty snowballs. So these are things that, you know, down at the root level, my work is being learned. It's setting up that next generation where they won't be fooled by the mainstream baloney that they're trying to pawn off on these poor kids in the standard educational systems. But at any rate, now here's an article. I saw this was a CNN on a money, watch your money type of article. So it shows that probably some of these people are listening to my show, because this is what I absolutely talked about many times. And that is to save your paperwork. Many people want to go green, go electronic with paper, with your bank accounts and everything. But don't do it completely. If you get your statements through the print out your bank statements, credit card statements, etc., and keep 1 month, at least the last month, on file. You don't have to keep years and years of this. I used to keep boxes and boxes of all of this going back years. But keep at least recent history on your, say, your utility bills, your house mortgage, other things like that, because the hacking of banks, of industries, of financial industries is going to become more common as the encryption systems have broken down. As I've stated before, there's a big kind of a rant I put on my webpage about prime numbers. They're still selling this broken encryption systems, firewalls, and encoded transmission systems. They're still selling these broken systems to the public and to industry. And the reason they're doing this is twofold. The companies that are selling them would have to retool and have to resell, and they'd have to admit that they're selling you garbage. And second of all, the NSA, who snoops into everybody's computers, would have to admit that the firewalls and the virus, antivirus protection, etc., that you're buying on the market allows the NSA easy access into your computers. And so this is a very complex issue. I've singled out the people in math analysis that are from, there's a small group of people working on prime numbers, but they're still touting the idea that prime numbers are invincible and uncalculable, and there's no order to them, which is totally false. It's a totally false mathematical result that they've been promoting, basically to save their cloistopoly. That's a term I coined about a week and a half ago on my webpage. It's a combination between cloister and monopoly. So there's no greater cloistopoly than in astronomy, space science, mathematics, mathematical analysis dealing with prime numbers, and other many other fields. I just wanted to mention, we 2 days ago was the Feast of Three Kings, and of course this is the major Christian holiday which follows Christmas. And I want to talk about the statistics of the three kings. Now, this is very interesting, and I've woven this topic into a special that I did with Brad Walton, my good friend and now deceased Brad, a couple years ago, died unexpectedly. But I did a special with him on WCCO Radio, one of the big radio stations out of Minneapolis. And but at any rate, going back to the story of the three kings. Now, the question here is, why were there three kings in the story? Now, if you were the power above and you wanted to make an impression on people, would you have two kings go, or one? And the answer is no. And why is it important that there were three? Because, first of all, they were from different lands. Second of all, they were all waiting, and they had been waiting not 10 years, not 100 years, but literally thousands of years to have this sign in the heavens appear that would lead them. And so these were all schooled in this when they passed through the other lands. Remember, there was the story where they met and they were being harbored they were safe harbor with one of the kings, and they got to talking, and then they decided, you know, we're not going to tell people what we're doing here, because they were afraid that word would get out, and they realized there was a lot of jealousy, which we see today in the science world. People are tremendously, horribly jealous of what I'm doing, because I'm an independent scientist. So imagine what leaders would be jealous of if they thought there was a baby being born who the story was that this person would rule and take over their their rulers, their kingships, etc. So anyway, the story is that the three kings continued on their journey. And by the way, this didn't happen overnight. The planning for these guys, these are kings. They're not just like beggars wandering across the desert. They are kings. They've come from three different countries. They all saw the same sign. And so what is the sign in the heaven? It's absolutely, it's a comet. It's a big comet, but it's a very unusual comet. Something very unusual about this comet. And what I've said before is it had to have had companions, and not only one companion, but probably two companions. Some strange cometary configuration that was a very special sign that they were looking for, that was the signal, the onset of the Messiah. But back to the three kings, not one, not two, but three. And the statistics here. Now, I'm a statistician. I've taught statistics at the university level. I work in statistics on my own projects. I use statistics. And so let's look at the significance, the statistical significance of just one king. You could say it's coincidence or it's a nice story. Okay. With two kings, you could still say it was coincidence. It just wasn't that impressive. But the weight of the third king being there gives you a tremendous amount of extra weight. It's like flipping a coin three times and getting three tails. And it's even more significant than that, because you're not just flipping coins. You have three people from three different countries who are intelligent. Now, these people watch the stars. They know the history. They understand what the significant sign is. They all see it. They pack their bags, and this didn't just happen overnight. They didn't just, throw a knapsack together and decide to cross the desert. These are kings. They travel with the equipment in their, they didn't run out the back door with a sandwich in a bag. Excuse me. They're kings. They brought gifts. They brought gifts from their own countries. So what's the significance of the three kings? It's more than just a couple guys, going out for a ride across the desert in their Porsche. This took them months, if possibly even years, to make this crossing. They meet together on the way, and then they encounter jealous kings on the way, and they decide not to talk to them anymore about what they're doing. But they realize that this guy, this king, where they're safe harbored, also understands what that sign up in the heaven is. They all know that this is the ushering in of the Messiah. So, three kings, not one, not two, but a statistically significant three kings. And so, now, the story about the Christmas star, and I want to reiterate this, it's very important because there's been so much emphasis put, coming from the misinformation standard science community, astronomy community, that this was just, a planetary alignment, which lasts at most for a few hours, and then it's gone. And they're going, there was a Jupiter-Venus-Mars alignment back to 2000 BC or something, some ridiculous story. But the point is that, no, this Christmas star hung out in the heavens for a long period of time. And to put the frosting on the cake, not only did the three kings follow this, but a shepherd boy did too. They followed this sign to where it stood over the place where the Christ child laid and was born. And so anyway, it's just, you see this entourage of people arriving at the same time. This is not coincidence. And you talk about the factors that are going on there and the significance. You know, that's why we're still talking about this a few thousand years later. It just wasn't your run-of-the-mill story. Okay, so anyway, the statistics of three kings. Very interesting. Okay, there's a mission that's going on right now, the New Horizons mission to visit the planet Pluto. They say already it's starting to take pictures of Pluto. They say by May, the pictures that they are going to get of Pluto will rival that of the Hubble Space Telescope. So after May, they're going to start to get better and better pictures of Pluto. Now, it turns out that Pluto, a number of years ago, had the first moon discovered called Charon. It's a relatively large moon, rivals Pluto in size. And remember that Pluto was demoted as being a planet. Excuse me. This thing has five moons around it now that have been discovered, and they'll probably discover more. So poor little Pluto out there has been demoted as being a planet, and the reason they did is because if they admitted that Pluto was a planet, then they'd all of a sudden have to admit that there were 40 more planets. And so they didn't want to do that. So there was a number of efforts to demote Pluto from being a planet, and it failed. And all of a sudden, some astronomers got together in Europe, and they voted it in, and they said, by the almighty edict of this small select group, certainly a cloistopoly there of astronomers, they declared that Pluto was no longer a planet and that everybody else had to follow. So anyway, I don't, not buying into that. Pluto, in my book, is still a planet. And we have many planets. We have dozens and dozens of new planets. But just on this New Horizons mission, as usual, the unsung heroes in this whole mission and all of NASA are the engineers, the guys that build these incredible spacecraft and guide them out to where they're supposed to go and have them work, and the ability to send an electrical radio signal, 3 billion miles through space, have this spacecraft wake up and do everything it's supposed to do. That is just a modern miracle in my estimation. These guys are just amazing. So the engineers that build these systems are the guys that deserve a lot of credit. Unfortunately, when it comes all said and done, the data filters back through a bunch of tier two scientists to come off to the public. And believe me, there's a group of tier one scientists that are out there collecting a lot of different data, and the tier two scientists never see it and never know about it, and it certainly never gets to you, the public. So at any rate, that's something I'll certainly be following, because Pluto, let's just look at this. Now, Pluto is supposed to be out there where it's cold and everything, but it shows sign of an atmosphere. So clearly the comet effect, because Pluto is out there far enough to be acting on that nebular ion cloud that I was talking about earlier, building up an atmosphere, and possibly because of the electrical current that's passing, is possibly even warm. I announced on my webpage the other day that Uranus, the planet Uranus, has developed since last, I think, August. They started seeing these tremendous cyclonic storms orbiting or moving in the atmosphere of Uranus, and they've been cycling ever since. Astronomers, space scientists have no idea why that should be happening, because if you look back at the sun from Uranus, the sun looks like just about another star. That's how dim the sun would look if you were out there. It's hardly significant at all. So where's the energy coming to drive these storm systems? And clearly, it's the discharge of the solar capacitor that I've been talking about. Just a quick notice here. The Council on Foreign Relations, this in from a listener, has developed a map of diseases and the level of diseases in countries around the world. The level of disease is most in countries with required vaccinations. Isn't that interesting. There's just another quick notice before I get into my main science topic dealing with Planet X. The Rosetta 67P nucleus, now this is a quote from the European Space Agency news release that just came out in the past week. They said that the nucleus is black as coal. Now this is standard for all comets that they visited. They are blacker than the blackest black that has ever been discovered in the solar system. Comet nuclei are the blackest. Now I want you to listen to this next statement. And I'm amazed they are saying this because this is an actual legitimate scientific result, something that NASA has hidden and tried to convolute. They said the surface composition, this is of the nucleus, Comet 67P, they said as black as coal. Here's a quote. Surface composition is fairly uniform and shows no sign of ice patches. They said that the ice would appear as blue, and there are none. The nucleus of Comet 67P that they have been studying with the Rosetta space mission, the surface composition is fairly uniform and shows no sign of ice. Now, are comets dirty snowballs? But then they preface that by saying, presumably ice is below the surface. Gee, boys and girls, when are they going to drop this fairy tale? When are they going to release and understand? But see, even if there were ice under the surface, it's not coming off to form the tail. It's a moot point at this stage of the game. Comets are not dirty snowballs. They never were, they never will be, and they aren't now. And the proof is in the pudding. The data is clear. I want to read this once again. Surface of Comet 67P, the nucleus, black as coal. The surface composition is fairly uniform and shows no sign of ice patches. On to my next topic. So I want to go back. I've pulled up this article about Planet X. And let me just read this, because I'm going to read it. And here's the title. It looks like this actually was pulled in from Science. And so Science is the equivalent of Nature in England. Science is the American kind of high-level, peer-reviewed, so supposedly top-of-the-line science. The article is by Michael Berger. And this was published December 1st, 2014, and weather.com. So I don't know if that date is the Science date or is that the weather.com date. I think that's the Science date, but anyway, the title, Are We Close to Discovering Planet X? I want to read that again, just because I'm sure some of you are still getting up off the floor after falling out of your chair laughing. Are we close to discovering Planet X? And then here's the caption. It says, is it possible there are other planets out there within our solar system? As Matt Sampson explains, some scientists are very excited about this theory and say they have even have evidence to support it. So, okay, here's the article. It says, the quest to find a Planet X in our solar system beyond Pluto continues. That means it's been going on for a while. So while the Phil Plates of the world have been nagging that there is no such thing, the little Tier 3 and 4 outreach goons that NASA puts out there to try and pound its party line, this search has been going on for a while. And they call it the search. It said the quest to find Planet X. I mean, how much clearer can that be? Could it possibly be that Jim McCanney was correct again? And by the way, with a sea of imposters and nutcases that the government puts out there, little old ladies that talk to aliens and say that the world is going to end May 15, 2003, just absurd. Okay, but at any rate, let me continue reading this. It says, I'll start reading again. I'm just going to read directly from this article. Okay, here we go. The quest to find planet X in our solar system beyond Pluto continues. And we may be a step closer to not one, but two undiscovered planetary masses. This past March, astronomer Scott Shepard of the Carnegie Institution of Science and Craig Trujillo of Gemini Observatory in Hilo, Hawaii, saw a new object, the most distant known in our solar system. This object, about 200 miles in size, and several near it, followed similar orbits, an unusual occurrence, according to Shepard. We would expect their orbits to be fairly random, he told weather.com. So we suspect something more massive is shepherding these. A planet, to be exact. They called it 2012 VP113, or VP for short, after Vice President Joe Biden, and reported their findings in the journal Nature. Okay, so it looks like their publication was in Nature. Since then, several other scientists have tried to find explanations for the orbit question, reporting in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomy Society letters in June, two researchers at Madrid's Complutense University concluded, based on their analysis, that two planets must exist beyond Neptune and Pluto. I want to read this again. It says, since then, several other scientists have tried to find explanations to the orbit question, reporting in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society newsletters in June. Two researchers at Madrid's Complutense University concluded, based on their analysis, that, listen to this, boys and girls, grandmas and grandpas, Phil Plate and everybody else, two planets must exist beyond Neptune and Pluto. Now, these are two planets besides the ones they've discovered here, this handful of little ones. Okay, another reported in the same journal in August that these planets are likely even more distant than imagined. Okay, so they've imagined this, so that means they've been thinking about this. Okay, so I'm going to continue reading. Shepard said other questions remain about these planets, not just whether they exist. How did this large object get out there, and where did it actually form? Did it form in our solar system, or did it actually get captured? Whoa, sounds like Jim McCanny's work here, a little bit of creeping crud. Get captured from another solar system. He noted that because objects like that cannot form in outer space, or in the outer solar system, they must have been tossed out there with the help of large planets like Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, or Neptune. Okay, so we're talking capture. Gee, wouldn't that sound like Jim McCanny's work? This is a very interesting announcement. Lots of creeping crud in this article. Okay, then it goes on to say, as to the always asked question about whether such a planet could hold life, see, they're not just talking about the existence anymore, they're talking about could it hold life. Shepard doesn't completely balk at the idea. It's always an interesting question, he said. The object, we wouldn't know anything about its composition to date because we haven't found it yet. But it could be a very ice-rich world. It could have organics on it, which are the ingredients for life. It might have the ingredients for life. To date, Shepard and Trujillo have covered just 5% of the sky. He said they hope to up to that number to about 20% in the next few years. New technologies like the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope will help trim down how long this process takes, but they won't be ready to use until the 2020s. For now, scientists keep looking beyond the far reaches of our solar system one little bit at a time, capturing people's imaginations. Gee, isn't that just swell? Capturing people's imagination with every new discovery. People were very upset when Pluto was demoted, Shepard said. It's very much in the public's mind. Well, yeah, it is. And the whole reason, as I have explained, was that because a cloistopoly of astronomers who wanted to keep you, the public, stupid, wouldn't wouldn't allow Pluto to remain as a planet, because if it did, they'd have to announce 40 more, and they just discovered another handful of them out there. There must be hundreds of them now that they've discovered, but they're not telling you about all of them. But I just want to read this one last sentence again. For now, gee, boys and girls, for now, scientists will keep looking beyond the far reaches of our solar system one little bit at a time, capturing people's imagination with every new discovery. Now, isn't that special? Wow, I can hardly believe this. So, like I say, go wake up Phil Plait out of his stupor and his moronic stupor and tell him he's out of a job. Astronomers have been looking for Planet X, in spite of the fact that he's still running around claiming there is no such thing. Anyway, whoosh, that is just beyond belief. That is beyond belief. And to have this reported in major news media like weather.com, clearly the people like myself are winning the battle. And this is a term used in battle. I mean, my good friend John Moore might have a more correct term for this, because there's a guy that's seen some action himself. But it's calling when you call in the flight support on your own position. There's a term for that, and I can't quite remember what it is, but basically you are telling your own Air Force to drop bombs right where you are, because the enemy is on top of you and your only hope of survival is that those bombs hit those guys and not you. And calling in air support on your own position is one way of saying it. This is what the astronomy community is doing, because everything I have been talking about is coming true. The public's listening to me and not those yo-yos. They got some new disinformation pages they're putting out there trying to soften me up and with a bunch of tier 3 people. One guy got his astronomy degree in 1994. Talk about a textbook repeater. But it's just comical. But this announcement is clear signal that I am just making a tremendous amount of headway with you, the public. And I mean, this goes back to, let's go back a half a decade. Coast to Coast AM had a debate. Well, they wanted a debate between standard science and someone to represent the Velikovsky story. Of course, they picked me to do that. Because I'm a credentialed scientist, I know what I'm talking about. I have my theoretical work that goes back decades. And I was right in Cornell at university when I published my peer-reviewed papers on these topics, and then seeing data come in for the first time. So they had me debate David Morrison. He's one of the top NASA honchos, you know, regarded as one of the top in the if you took all of NASA and you wanted to pick somebody who would be a spokesperson, he was Carl Sagan's student. Good grief, you couldn't ask for somebody more central. I debated him on Coast to Coast AM and won the debate with a call-in vote, which simply means, and it was by a few percentage points, but the point is, with the billions and billions of dollars, like Carl Sagan used to say, billions and billions of dollars that NASA has spent with tremendous influence campaigns trying to influence you, the public, I won the debate. little old me. When I started that, I said, I'm just going to get wiped off the map. The call-in vote, I'm going to lose this debate 1-0. But I went on to present the case in an orderly, rational manner, and I won the debate. So that tells me that I don't have a drop of government funding, never did, never will. I do this myself. I pay for my own airtime for this radio show, and I bring my books to you, the public, etc. And you are listening to me more than you're listening to them. This article, that these people have been searching for Planet X for a long time, these automated search programs, so why didn't they release this information? Why are they releasing it now, Christmas time, 2014, why are they releasing it now, in spite of the fact they still got fleets of Tier 3 and 4 outreach people out there claiming that Planet X is a nut topic, when in fact they have searched, professional astronomers have been searching for Planet X, and that's what they call it. So they're dropping this message to you, the public, because the public is so far advanced. If they don't drop this message, they will completely lose all credibility, even the smidgen that they might have remaining. I think this is just amazing. So this is the literal academic astronomical equivalent of calling down your own firepower on your own position, because they have to admit it now. I'm just waiting for the admission that comets are not dirty snowballs, and there you, I've just read that. They've talked about the electrical activity around Comet 67P, the European Space Agencies, and I bet you those guys over there going, hey, we're not going to sacrifice our career because they see the future. They see 10, 20 years down the line. If they don't fold over and start talking about what I'm doing, they're going to look like a bunch of real buffoons in history. Do they want to look good now in the eyes of NASA and keep NASA funding? Or do they want to go for the long term and start admitting that what I'm doing is correct and start going down? Because in 10 years, 15 years, 100 years, that my story is the one that's going to stand, not the dirty snowball comet model, little just beyond fairy tale science. That's not going to stand. It doesn't stand today. It certainly isn't going to stand in the future. It's going to be the laughing stock of the future. And so is the European Space Agency scientist going to buy off his future in the vista from history, looking back on this time period? Or is he going to go with the NASA story? Anyway, I just wanted to close by, I got about a minute left here. Go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. I have some postings there. And as always, the water filter products are there. There's still a 10% sale going on the water filter products. And the calendar, the recalendar Sunstar clock is there, the pre-filter, all of those items you will not find any place else. And also, I just want to thank the listenership out there. Sometimes this gets very difficult for me because, unfortunately, we're living in a world where we're fighting a tremendously uphill battle. And there's times when I just feel like I'm the Lone Ranger out here with a one voice of sanity in a sea, an absolute ocean of insanity. But I know there's listeners who appreciate what I do, and that's why I keep doing this. So I'm out of time. We'll talk to you next week. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.